Debbie said, this is really a completely group effort. I won't have be able to mention every student involved, but it's really been quite a big thing getting this together on top of all the other things that we've had to do. So, as Ken said, we have its fault rupture is right to the west of Christchurch, about 40 kilometers, and it broke down to a depth of at least 12 kilometers. And there had not been any before. One interesting thing about this is that there had not been any evidence on the surface for previous earthquakes in the landforms. Often geologists can go look and see that there's been a mountain developing or rivers being offset, and they can say there's been an earthquake there. But nobody had known that that was here because it was buried under a huge amount of gravel. Okay, and it was 90 kilometers southeast of the Alpine Fault, which had been considered and still is the most likely of the huge earthquakes to happen. But this 7.2, as Ken said, could have happened anywhere. Okay, the kind of earthquake it was a strike-slip earthquake where the ground just slides past itself. And that was another thing Ken didn't mention because he didn't want to get too complicated about it. But those focal mechanisms he showed you at the beginning, the fault plane solutions, those actually told them not only that it was the east-west fault plane, but that it was this strike-slip kind of motion where you would get things just sliding past each other rather than moving too much up and down. Okay, so that's the rupture surface. Then, as expected, after earthquakes, there are aftershocks. What happens is that the movement of the ground is causes forces in the rest of the area around it, which disrupts the previous forces. So things are jostled around, and those cause further jostling. So you get a lot more earthquakes, which are these aftershocks from the main event. So in here, the blue circle is the main shock, and you can see that the aftershocks are not all exactly at the same spot, but they're spread out a little bit more east-west than north-south, but not even that much for sure here. And some of them are near Christchurch. So some of the people think that things are bigger because the Christchurch people feel them more. Some of that is just because the earthquakes are closer to Christchurch, or perhaps closer to the surface. So this is just a picture of how the aftershocks have moved in time. This was made a couple days ago. And one thing mainly to see here, the colors represent time. So the zero is the main shock, and the reds are the most recent ones. And pretty much we were hoping we might see some kind of pattern, but basically there is not really much of a pattern here. It just is kind of a jumble of earthquakes popping off randomly at different positions at different times. Okay, then we can also take what we call a cross-section or a depth slice. This is just an east-west, which since the earthquake was east-west oriented, the fault rupture was east-west, it's the right place to do it. So we're just going to take a cut in the ground from east-west. So here we're looking at the earthquake depths. We're plotting the earthquakes again as a function of time with the colors. And this is west-east along the longitude line. So again, that main shock was kind of in the middle, a little bit closer to the bottom than most of the other aftershocks. That's pretty normal for big earthquakes. But there's not much of a pattern. These lines are just artifacts of the location procedure. They'll really spread out once we get a better location. And then our colleagues from overseas were, as Ken mentioned, were very quick on the ball. What they do is they take seismic stations from around the world, and then they use those. They have programs, and they go every time there's an earthquake, a big earthquake. They run their programs. They get these seismic stations, and they figure out how the ground moved right near the earthquake. So they can do this without needing to know exactly all the stuff from the GeoNet network. They actually can do this from all the other stations around the world. But they only get a very a small picture of this, but they can get it rapidly. And what they found here, here's the earthquake, again, similar to our locations before, but they found that the earthquake ruptured away from Christchurch, so it ruptured from the east to the west, and it seemed to come kind of sideways, like we said, the strike slip, but actually there's also a little bit of
vertical motion here towards the west. So as I said, a complex event, there's some strike slip, some vertical, and they then could look at the time distribution of the slip. So this is another graph that may be a little complicated. We have here is the energy. So this line shows you how much energy occurred at different times since the beginning. So in the first 10 seconds, there was one big pulse of energy that came out, and then it dropped down, and then there was another taller pulse that came through to a higher amount, but in a shorter time period. So some of you, I in particular am a light sleeper, and I was already awake before the earthquake happened, and I felt several different pulses happening, and I was wondering what was going on. Why weren't there just two pulses from a P and an S wave to locate an earthquake? In fact, it's because it was a complex rupture. So we'll be able to get much better detailed pictures when we put in the full GeoNet solutions in this. This was just the stations they could have from overseas. But we'll get an even better, more detailed map in the near future. This is just one of the other things we can do. It's a very preliminary model, but it just shows you the kinds of things that can happen with earthquakes. Here's the earthquake. We've done is we've taken one of our overseas colleagues' solutions and said, if we have that earthquake, what areas are going to have more stress added to them, more forces to cause future earthquakes from that rupture by itself? So the red areas are where we'd expect more earthquakes, and the blue is where we'd expect somewhat less. You can see this is very preliminary. Many things are just averages and very quickly done, and so we'll get better detailed ones in the future. But in general, you can see that we do have more aftershocks in these areas that are red, where we expect more interaction. So we can understand the interaction between earthquakes by doing these kinds of methods here. Okay, then we have this movie that some people may already have seen. It's been on YouTube, and it was presented by the GNS science team. You can see we are looking at fault ruptures in here. This is one of our beginning slides. You can see there's a shift here in this canal, these various little cracks at the surface that are coming through, where you can see there's a little bit of vertical motion. It's also a bit wide. You can see quite a range where the cracks are going across. And we see here it went under farm buildings, between farm buildings, and it's shifting the line of trees around, that strike slip nature. We have 4 meters of displacement across sideways. And then there's a little bit of vertical motion, about 1 meter vertically. We can see lots of surface cracking here. There's we call pressure ridges, they're just kind of pushed upward. And there was 22 kilometers for the initial trace for the mapping of the fault. Okay, so one of the interesting things here, I think this is one of the nicest pictures of an earthquake strike slip faulting that you can see. We have the road, which of course was initially straight, has now been pushed aside, so these cars coming down would have to shift over very rapidly. And then it was also a little bit of vertical motion. So this is about 4 meters measured here and about 1.6 meters. This is the maximum vertical motion. You can see a little bump in there. And of course, people are not supposed to drive across that because it's unstable. Now, this would happen in this plain where nobody had seen any things like this before, so nobody knew there was a fault there. But in other areas, this is from my colleague Tim Little, further north, it looks like very similar structures have happened, but over thousands of years, there have been, say, tens of these kinds of earthquakes. So if we had 10 of these pushing upward, we end up getting 120 meters horizontal offset and 20 meters vertical offset. And he's measured these in the field in the Wairarapa, anyway, so he's measured the field, these measurements in the field, and they can see the same kinds of things, rivers being pushed sideways as they cross the fault, and downwards and upwards motion on the fault. Okay, aftershocks. There's been a lot of concern in the news and people, the aftershocks certainly are keeping on occurring and they will continue for a while. They always do. And people are feel them and they get very much afraid. But in fact, they have been decaying as we expect. It's been coming less and less frequently. What we have plotted here are these little sticks have the height of the magnitude of the event. And every time there's an earthquake, there's a stick. And we just have them as a function of the date of the earthquake. So it's moving along in time here. You can see the sticks are all really close together here. And they move further apart out here. And the size of the sticks is varying pretty randomly up and down. In general, they're getting smaller, like we expect for magnitudes. And so far, there's been just the main shock over magnitude 6. There have been 10 between 5 and 6, and then 72 between 4 and 5, and a lot more smaller ones. They haven't even been able to measure all of the ones that are smaller than 4 because it's been so many to do. Okay, so then in general, we expect them to continue at the same kinds of rates, to slow down. They'll get smaller and less frequent over the next few months. But again, we can expect these little bumps in activity, and on average, we might expect one or two more magnitude 5 or greater events still to come. But that's just an average over time. That probability will go down as well. Just like the magnitude 6 probability, some people might have heard people talk about that there might be a magnitude 6. Well, there could be, but that probability has gone way down. The longer you wait, the less likely that 6 is to happen. So we're quite unlikely to have it now. Okay, so don't worry if you've got people there. One of the other things that has been in the last 15 or 20 years been able to use is GPS. Okay. Now, most of you are familiar with GPS. You can get them in your cars now and find out exactly where you are and what kind of turn you can take. It'll tell you to turn right or left at the stop sign. It's very, very convenient. And we've also been able to use these scientifically to measure how the ground moved. So particularly GNS science has been out there for many years putting benchmarks in the ground, and there's several continuous GPS sites just sit there and they measure where they are with respect to satellites flying overhead. So most of the time, this is an east-west component. Most of the time you move along and maybe it's getting slightly more westward as we go along, but about 200 millimeters from where it started. But now we move along and then all of a sudden the earthquake happens and boom, it's gone down by 100 millimeters. Okay, that's just one station at Queens Valley. This particular one went down 100 millimeters from east to west, so it went westward 100 millimeters, and the north component went up, so it went northwards by 50 millimeters. And so we can see that in here. And then if we just put this on the map, then this site MQZ, which is not near the epicenter, so it's only 10 centimeters if you want to translate. It's not the meter that they were measuring, the geologists were measuring, because we're looking further away. But even here, we're not right next to the fault. Compared to the satellites, to this absolute motion, there was 135 millimeters to the north, west-northwest. Okay. And so quite similar to the motion on the ground. Okay, and what you can see here as well is all these stations that were already operating, the permanent network from the GeoNet seismic. So these red ones are broadband seismic networks. These green ones are measuring strong ground motion, which is what you get from the biggest shocks. It's what most people feel. Whereas the red ones are measuring lots of tiny ones that nobody can feel. There were lots of seismometers out, and once we have enough time to analyze it all, we'll get a lot more information than those overseas people were able to get. But in addition, there was kind of not quite as many as there could be out here. And so one of the things that we've all been doing in the last week is to put out a network of temporary seismometers to really more carefully be able to measure the locations of the aftershocks. This will actually help us to also go back and re-measure some of the earlier events before the temporary one. So this is a little bit complicated here. It's still a map from Google Earth, with the pink dots being the aftershocks that you might have seen already. And the pins here are various seismometer combinations that are being put out. The greens were the ones that were out pretty much on Sunday and Monday. By Sunday and Monday, they put them out in the field already. And the reds and yellows are ones that are coming out later, and we're going to be using them to understand the fault structure. We might be able to use them to help map the location of possible other faults in the area and really understand better how this earthquake occurred. This is the same picture, but without the aftershocks, so you can see a little more how many instruments we're putting in this area. In addition, there's going to be 200, some people may have heard about, I didn't even put them on here, but they're putting out 200 strong motion seismometers as well from Stanford University to look more at the variation between the different building sites and why were certain areas more affected in Christchurch than others. So they've been asking for people to put them in their houses. But this is this picture of our people in the field, putting them out literally in the field. And they get permission from farmers, who've been all very nice, very happy to accommodate us and let us put the seismometers in the ground. They're digging, we put cement in the ground, and the seismometers dig the hole. And they're dedicated people, even working late at night, so they keep on shining the light for each other to try to get these out as soon as we can, so we can really understand where the earthquakes are occurring and what's happening there. Okay, so in summary, we were very lucky that there were no fatalities, and this was partly due to the time of the earthquake, and almost, though, lots of good planning and also luck. So there was time of day was very important. People were asleep and not near those chimneys that were falling. And the building codes had made almost all the new buildings survive very well. With the older brick buildings, people's chimneys that were left were the problem. It was the biggest one on the land for nearly 80 years. And the bricks and the liquefaction areas were the most damaged. There were many aftershocks. They're going to continue to happen for some time. And produced a break in the ground surface and with strike slip motion. And we're going to be still, it's going to take us several years to really understand fully what happened with this earthquake. So what are the kinds of things we're doing? What more do we need to know? Well, as we showed you, we're recording, we're deploying more seismometers to record the aftershocks. We've got people looking at satellite and GPS data to investigate the surface deformation, not just right on the fault, but in the whole area around it, like that station we showed you. There's people from the architecture at the UW and some of the people from GNS are also looking at building damage. Engineers are out there, and we're going to be comparing it to ground motion. There's social scientists going out studying emotional impact and preparedness, and there's heaps of more wide range of research that I don't have time to talk about, and probably I don't even know all of what's going on. There's so many people working on it, and we don't have so much time to talk to everybody yet. So what are we hoping to learn? Again, this is just a brief thing. Why did Christchurch get off so lightly? It wasn't that well damaged. We're going to be, it's good that it got off lightly, and we want to figure out whether we can keep that for everybody else as well. We want to look at how we can find other unknown faults, whether we can determine how earthquakes interact with each other and use that understanding to better predict future earthquakes and their likelihoods. How can we improve community readiness, response, and resilience? And can we put these together to improve our buildings and the building codes so buildings stand up better and we don't have to just be lucky next time. We can have even better buildings. Okay, so these, again, we had quite a few contributors and collaborators from most of the universities in the country and some overseas universities. Our funding agencies, EQC and FRISP particularly, the GNET and various research programs funded by EQC, the Hazard Platform and many other portfolios as well from FRISP, Ministry for Community Development, and LINZ, Land Information New Zealand, they're all been contributing money for this. So, thank you. We have questions.
Yeah, just a simple question. I think the land has shifted to the west, but the southern Alps are to the west, so does the land just compress up against the Alps, or what happens to that? It can't sort of slide out into the Tasman.
That's a very good question. Yes, the structure to the west is right at the place where the geologists have mapped it. You've seen those pictures, you can see that shifting, but at the edges, it does get compressed, and so it's pushing towards the Alps. And that's kind of what you'll be measuring with the GPS instruments. You can see that push, even though it's not broken surface. That's what you see, is pushing towards it, and it's going to get smaller and smaller. The actual motion will get smaller towards the Alps. It's compression.
That's what I was talking about in the beginning, the sliding along the Alpine Farm, that was also the pushing in. It's that pushing in that actually built the Alps. That's the process that's going on all the time.
But actually there also is, one part is compressing, another part is expanding as well, so there's both. It's a strike slip, you get both happening.
That's a good one. We get asked that all the time. You've probably noticed in the last few days we've seen a couple of magnitude 5 plus in the North Island as well, and people ask if they are related. Well, as I said at the beginning, New Zealand is here because of the plate boundary. So they're on the same plate boundary, but we don't understand the mechanism that would directly connect them yet. But I'm not going to say they're not connected.
Yeah, the answer is we don't really know.
We have relatives in Christchurch, and I've been providing some scientific advice for my son and grandchildren who are terrified. But I found a very useful website, www.christchurchquake.org.
Yeah, that's the Ministry of Civil, that it's been set up for as a clearinghouse by the government. Is
it's a student, I think. Christchurchquakemap.co.nz. I was tricked on television, essentially a geek, very nice geek, who has this wonderful map that shows in real time the size and depth.
That's the one of the earthquake pop on, kind of like our one with the blue and red colors, but it pops on actually.
That is basically taking a real time a feed from our website. And then repackaging it.
Well, one question about the data from that website that I've also downloaded. All of the stuff seems to be 10K, 20K, except for four quakes. According to the printout, at plus 1.5 hours, plus 2 hours, plus 2.5 hours, and plus 15 hours, quakes at depths of respectively 58, 89, 88, and 123, all near Lincoln.
I suspect...
That data?
Yeah. Okay. Apparently, our systems are working very hard to cope with that.
Yeah.
And anybody taking a close to real-time feed, they'll be getting some that aren't.
So
Well, in general, peak shaking is usually almost always side to side more because of the way that the waves are set up. So it would have been more side to side again. Buildings are built to withstand up and down.